And good evening, I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
You're watching Consider This, the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know about the news of the day. Now, the water disruption in the Klang Valley, that's dominated headlines over the past weekend. 1.2 million consumer accounts were affected since last Thursday when four water treatment plants had to be shut after pollutants were detected in a river. Now, the plants have since resumed operations and supply is being restored in stages. And the Selangor MB, while his strident promise to demolish the offending factory was well received, the tables, however, have turned on him when his wife posted an Instagram story of a water truck at their official residence, as well as some photos of family members in their swimming pool. Now, public outrage followed suit with the presumption that the water was meant for recreational purposes. But both the MB and his wife have apologized, clarifying that the water was not meant for the pool. However, my question is whether it's enough to actually quench the ire of the public. What do you think, Sharad?
These are troubling times on so many fronts. And right. I think, Melissa, you know, to have to add to the woes and the misery
and the frustrations that we have, right,
as a public over so many issues, to add the water problem to it. This is not the consequence of a drought or, you know, we've had torrential downpours. This has to do with something going wrong in the system, right?
Oh, yes.
The system of water management. But coming back to the Menteri Besar Selangor and his particular problems, he's asked the public not to carry on this discussion.
Yes, not to harp on it.
But of course, as we all know, there's no controlling these stories. There's no controlling the way in which bad press travels. It will travel until it needs to travel.
Well, because the optics were so poor. I mean, the optics, the timing. Granted, the wife of the Menteri Besar, Masdiana Muhammad, has apologised. But I'm not quite sure whether that was enough to kind of undo the damage that was done by the poor optics.
Right. So the question is, you know, people who are related to politicians, their spouses, their family members, extended family, do they think of themselves as somehow in the same, under the same kind of public scrutiny, the same glare as their partners are? And, you know, and if so, do they need to somehow be counseled in terms of managing their personal, you know, social media accounts, in terms of things they say that might be picked up in a much more public setting?
Are you talking about like public relations training or media training,
Indeed, what not to do
during a crisis?
Absolutely. So there is a crisis. People are going to be unhappy. They're going to want to blame someone. Your partner is in a public office and is likely to be the target of some of that blame. What should you not do?
Okay, well, what about this? The fact that at least there was an apology. Quite forthcoming in the apology. Granted, you know, saying that let's move on and talk about other things. So wanting bad press to go away may not necessarily make bad press go away. But the fact that there was an apology, if you compare that to some politicians who don't even bother apologising.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, we've had politicians neither apologising or being honest in their assessment of what's happened. They throw colleagues under the bus. So we've had all manner of responses coming from the political elite. This, of course, I think probably on the positive end of the spectrum in terms of recognizing that the optics of it were just bad. And also, I think, addressing the questions that are very central to the way the public views what's happening in this country is the privilege that political elite have. You know, why was a water truck there specially for the Menteri Besar's house? I mean, so on and so forth.
Definitely. And I do particularly like the point that you made at the start, saying that this is beyond just the issue of public inconvenience. We have to go beyond that. This is actually more than that. It's fundamental. There are institutional issues here, institutional failures here that we need to address. And we're going to come back to the issue of the security of our water resources in just a couple of minutes and address that in the rest of the show. But first, in other news, effective today, long-term pass holders from countries that have recorded more than 150,000 COVID-19 cases, they have been barred from entering Malaysia. Now, the countries include the US, the UK, India, Philippines, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia, just to name a few. And the ban involves six categories of pass holders, and those include the people with permanent resident status, Malaysia My Second Home program participants, and also professional expatriates. Now, also barred are spouses of Malaysian citizens and their children, as well as students from Indonesia, Philippines, and India, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, now, so that's almost every BRIC country in the world. Also, I wonder about Europe. I mean, should Europe be considered as one in this particular move by the government? It left me bewildered because, Melissa, we're not talking about opening the gates to tourists from all these countries. We're talking about people who have an existing relationship to the country. They have long-term pass holders. How many could there be? And surely, if these are the people who want to cross borders, come back to Malaysia or so on and so forth, surely the existing quarantine and testing regimes are enough to deal with the question of whether they will pose a danger.
Well, isn't that the point of, you know, testing and quarantine is to allow people to come in, but you have to observe the SOPs. And I really do wonder, you know, the thinking behind this policy. Was there rationale for picking the 150,000 arbitrary number of cases? Was there an epidemiology thinking behind that figure, picking that number for those countries? You know, and it's really quite interesting to think about whether there was science behind this policy. Yeah. What are the trade-offs of, you know, not having these people come, being allowed to come into the country versus, you know, keeping our borders closed?
Yeah, and the first point that you were making about the science of it, Melissa, you know, again, you know, it's 150,000 is the absolute number, not relative to the size. So in India with over a billion people versus a country with a smaller population, some countries are so small that, you know, they might have a much more chronic situation, but they might not have as many people positive,
right? Is it per capita? Are we talking about cases per capita?
Yeah, and also then the question of cases, right? So positive cases, not necessarily people sick, but would be dependent on the testing. Right?
Mm.
So if we look at Malaysia, we don't do massive testing. So then would we, by our own standards, fall short? I mean, would you then say, well, it doesn't matter, so the country doesn't test so much, but they, so they have smaller numbers of positives, we could let them in. So it really bewilders me, this policy, Melissa, but I think we'll hope for more clarity if, you know, journalists are at those press conferences and are allowed to ask more critical questions.
Okay, we're gonna take a quick break, but after this, we'll take on the issue of the persistent problem of pollution in our water catchment areas. That's all coming up in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned to Consider This.